We'll go ahead and get started while sharing the room. I want to welcome everyone. Today, Professor Hill will be here for part one of a special two-part discussion of certain themes in Ayn Rand's novels. The topic specifically is about allegory, propaganda, and didacticism in the novels of Ayn Rand. I'd ask everyone to please share the room and raise your hand if you want to join the conversation. Jason, thanks so much for doing this topic today. I'm intrigued by the title. I'm just going to let you go to it, and I look forward to hearing these examples.
Okay, great. Thanks, Scott. So over the years, as I've taught Rand's novels in courses, there's a course I've taught called The Philosophical Novel or Philosophy of Literature. And I've taught her in the comparative literature department. I've heard the refrain from students that it's a brilliant novel. It's brilliant philosophy, but it's a terrible novel. And this has come from students who are very, very sympathetic to Rand's philosophy. Some of them are philosophy majors. Some of them are literature majors, econ majors. And I'm going to sort of parse out the students who are hostile to Rand's philosophy. And these are students, I must say, with, you know, very refined literary sensibilities. And when I've taught her work in the comparative literature department also, the criticisms are more direct. They not only think that the philosophy is amazing, but the novel is horrible. And when I've taught The Fountainhead and We the Living, they said compared to The Fountainhead and We the Living. We the Living is a fabulous literary novel. The Fountainhead is a great novel. Atlas Shrugged is a crappy novel. And so, you know, I've asked them why, and I've been thinking about this myself, having read all her novels, of course. And they say the novel is overly didactic, it's propagandistic, it's too allegorical in its scope, and it's just a mere vehicle for various iterations of a repetitive philosophic system. And they've said also, because I do teach, I teach two types of literature in the comparative literature department besides teaching philosophy. I teach a work on the Victorian novel, and I also teach works in the romantic novel, and they most vehemently say that Atlas Shrugged is not a work in romanticism, given the 18th century writers of the form. So over the years, recognizing that these views are not entirely uncharitable, I mean, there are people who are just hateful of Rand, and I just sort of, I don't ignore them, but I'm not using their criticisms as part of this talk, that their views are not entirely uncharitable. And, you know, having a degree in literature myself, and then having read her novels very charitably and enjoyed them tremendously, and subjecting them to the same kind of literary meaning tests as I would any other novel, it forces me to appraise a novel by certain literary meaning tests that I think the students are to some degree doing. So I want to make the case that the novels, especially Atlas Shrugged, in this particular talk, cannot be read as a conventional novel. And I also want to make the case that it is not primarily a work in romanticism or romantic realism, given the understanding that we have of romanticism coming out of the tradition. So when we look at romanticism as we see it from various writers like Wordsworth, like Coleridge, like I'm just going to read through some of the basic points of romanticism, Coleridge and the second generation romantics like Wordsworth. When we look at the work of people like Novalis and we look at the work of William Blake, there are basically five characteristics of romanticism: an interest in the common man, intellectual, a strong sense strong senses, emotions, and feelings. And one thing that you find coming out in all the Romantics is an awe of nature, a celebration of the individual, the importance of imagination, the primacy of feelings over emotion, the primacy of feelings over reason, and an emphasis on nature. The Romantics emphasize healing, the healing power of the imagination, and believe that it could enable people to transcend their troubles and their circumstances. And their creative talents, they believe that their creative talents could illuminate and transform the world into a coherent vision to regenerate mankind spiritually. Other tenets of the Romantic movement, the Romantics really saw Romanticism really as a sort of interesting schematic explanation which brings about or establishes, again, the predominance of imagination over reason and formal rules, classicism over the sense of fact or the actual realism, a formula which Calls Hazlitt's statement of 1816 that the beauty of a Greek temple can reside chiefly in its actual form and its actual connotations, while the romantic beauty of a Gothic building or ruin arose from the associate ideas which the imagination was stimulated to conjure up. So the Romantics really are concerned, or were concerned with a certain romantic mood in the psychological desire to escape from unpleasant realities. Just more briefly also, they saw art as a formulation of intuitive imagination or imaginative perceptions that tend to speak a noble truth than that of fact, logic, or the here and now. And it sees in nature, actually, a revelation of truth, the living garment of God, and often pantheistically, a sensate portion of the deity itself. Okay, so when Rand says that her work is a form of romanticism, I don't see it sort of capturing any of the classical statements of romanticism that I've studied in Handbook to Literature by William Harman, or coming out any of the out of any of the writings of the Romantics. When she says romantic art is a recreation of reality according to an artist's value judgments, and that her work is romantic because it presents reality or life as it ought to be. I'm going to make Jennifer moderator. I'm sorry. Let me hold on here.
She actually stepped away for a moment. It's all right. I just made you one, but I'm one as well.
Oh, okay. I'm not seeing any of the basic tenets of romanticism in her work, and so I'm gonna argue that show my bias here. I think Atlas Shrugged is a great work of art, but I think that ultimately at the end of my talk, I'm gonna say that we have to call this novel something else. So I want to make the case that the novel that it can't be read as a conventional novel. It is not purely a work in romanticism or romantic realism. It is one of the most didactic novels, I think, in the history of novel writing. It is highly allegorical, and I'm going to talk about what constitutes an allegory. And it perhaps in the end, when one answers the question, who is John Galt, it ends up being a sort of intellectual Romana Clef, in the sense that it's Ayn Rand. And when we look at the interchangeability of the characters, Rourke sounds like Reardon, who sounds like Dancogne, who sounds like Galt, who sounds like Dagny, who sounds like Hugh Axton, who sounds like Steve Mallory, who sounds like Dagny. There's a way in which all the characters are interchangeable and intellectually fungible. And in this sense, it seems to be Rand's voice that is permeating all the characters intellectually. So there's a sort of univocality of intellectual identity that permeates all the characters, which makes them interchangeable. And in this sense, I want to say that Atlas Shrugged could be argued as a novel that is not a romanoclef in terms of events, but in terms of what it really means, which is a novel that has the extra literary interest of portraying a real person, more or less thinly disguised as a fictional character. That's a sort of controversial claim to make, but I do want to make it. So these figures may be literal stand-ins for Ayn Rand herself. And I think when you look at the John Gall speech, and when you look at the comet, I'll get to that later, the comet train catastrophe that happens where people are killed off, and you look at the commentary that Rand makes about all these people, from the sociology professor to the man in room at car 2 who was a journalist, and the man in room car number 14 who was a professor of philosophy. The wording and the characterization of these people are Rand's, which makes the novels to me come across as a romanoclef. So I think these are literal stand-ins for Rand. And indeed, given the absence of any significant character development, I think in Rourke and Galt and Dancogne, there is some characterization in Reardon. These figures are just almost like full-blown from the head of Zeus. They're like Athenian figures. They are intellectual. They have a univocality, of identity intellectually, that seemed to be part of Rand's own identity intellectually. So one does not present a new theory of philosophy, including a new morality, with normative prescriptives that are teaching people, I think, teaching people how to be moral without deploying a great deal of didacticism. Now, I think contrary to Rand's assertion that her job was not to teach people anything, but to create the ideal, or to create the ideal man, whom persons could contemplate as an end in himself in an aesthetic manner, I think it's psychologically untenable that most people in the empirical world would find deliverers of long 10-page speeches or 4-page speeches on philosophical matters of aesthetics, epistemology, economics, worthy of aesthetic contemplation. They're worthy of philosophical meditation, and one learns a great deal about economics and the meaning of sex and the meaning of altruism and so on and so forth. But in reading Atlas Shrugged, for example, I have always had a pen in hand and a notebook, taking notes from the speeches and the observations, I think, made by Ayn Rand through the mirrored characters deployed to articulate aspects of her philosophy. So pure brains encased in flesh, delivering brilliant monologues on epistemology, on ethics, on psychology, moral psychology, can be well intellectually exciting, but I don't find anything aesthetically pleasing as such about John Galt, who literally, no pun intended, is a talking head, a brilliant talking head, but a person who exists fundamentally from the neck up. In other words, the characters are highly overly intellectualized, which is proper since they are allegorical figures espousing a particular philosophy. Now, what is an allegory? Well, an allegory is a form of extended metaphor in which objects or persons or actions in a narrative, either in prose or verse, are equated with actions that lie outside the narrative itself. So it represents one thing in the guise of another, an abstraction in that of a concrete image. So the characters are usually personifications of abstract qualities, and the action and the setting representative of the relationships of those abstractions. So allegory attempts to evoke a dual interest, one in the events, characters, and setting presented, and the other in the ideas they're intended to convey or the significance they bear. And the characters, the events, and setting may be historical, fictitious, or fabulous, The test is that these materials be so employed that they represent meanings independent of the actions in the surface story. So it is important, but by no means easy, to distinguish between allegory and symbolism, which attempts to suggest other levels of meaning without making a structure of ideas the controlling influence in the work as it is in allegory. So the tree trunk in the beginning of start of Atlas Shrugged would be a symbol, because the trunk, the hollowness of the trunk, goes on to be a symbol that displays the hollowness, the intellectual and moral bankruptcy of the dystopian world that Rand intends to show. That's a symbol. John Galt is not a symbol. He's an allegorical figure in the sense that he's an example of one form of allegory, which is called an exemplum. And basically, an exemplum is an example of a story that used to illustrate an ethical point. So he's a character within a story that's used to illustrate an ethical point. So in one sense, Atlas Shrugged, while the Fountainhead is the idealization of an architect, Atlas Shrugged, we could say, is the canonization of capitalism. And that's what makes it an exemplum, which is a part of an allegorical story. Okay, so I think Rourke can only work if he's treated also in some sense as an allegorical figure, less so than John Galt. But no one can be like Rourke, nor can, might it be psychologically healthy to attempt to be like him, or one runs the risk of becoming isolated, a little bit antisocial. But the Fountainhead and Atlas are exemplums and forms of allegories that illustrate an ethical point in the Fountainhead, and an ethical point in Atlas Shrugged, an epistemological point, and a canonization of capitalism. So there is very little variation, for example, in the linguistic stylization of the characters. There's a sort of ubiquitous way of talk that gives a philosophic coherence and systematicity to the novel. But if we take it as a traditional novel, that's going to mar it literally, right? But we can't take it as a traditional novel. Atlas cannot be seen as a traditional novel. The philosophy supersedes everything. I think the story are handmaidens to the new system Rand was working out. I think in one of the cruelest and inhumane scenes in Atlas, the crash scene of the comet, where villains who held faulty metaphysical, epistemological, altruistic views are offed, they're killed off, can be one charitable way of interpreting this would be an appeal to the way in which the interconnection of philosophy and production are irrevocably tied, right? So a faulty epistemology and faulty metaphysics lead to train crashes, but the story does not end there. There's almost an element of psychopathy, where Rand introduces her own indictment, and those made to die are guilty, right? The random passengers have sinned sufficiently to substitute for the known looters. Thus, the man in, you know, I'll just read one example. In bedroom car number one was a professor of sociology who taught that individual ability was of no consequence, that individual effort is futile and individual conscience is a useless luxury. And this goes on in 16 instances by car, taking up 1,000 words. So Rand has an array of illustrations of people who die, and detonations that end up killing a lot of people who die for their beliefs. So I think Rand's intrusion into the novel at this point seems hyperbolic and moralistic and superfluous, and emerges as a proof of Atlas as a sort of romantic cleft. That is, Rand is making her voice be heard And when you read that section, it becomes very clear that the voice of the novelist is also the voice of Mallory, Reardon, Rourke, Dagny, and Galt. And so I think this is probably inescapable given the kind of novel she was writing. So Atlas can only serve first as a philosophic didactic system with interjected secondary story elements, and the philosophy overpowers and dominates the story. The characters are literally Randian podcasts airing Ayn Rand's objectivism, and the stories are encasements. So seen in this manner, Atlas is fundamentally philosophically encased in a formulaic, highly stylized, fictionalized form. And there's nothing startling about Rourke's blowing up of Cortland or the plot structure of the device of the Fountainhead, or even of the fantastical plot structure of Atlas Shrugged. The story qua story is not a page turner. It's the unfolding of philosophical ideas, the psychological insights and analyses of human motivations that are the page turners, I think. And I think the luminous and brilliant texture of Rand's writing itself, its lucidity, its capacity to reveal a psychology behind villainy and the genesis or the genius in human certainty. So Rand was developing a new philosophic system, and like her predecessor Nietzsche, was functioning like a moral psychologist. That is, her work investigates how human beings function relentlessly, unavoidably in moral contexts. And these moral contexts themselves, as presented in her novels, are not multitudinous or complex. They're stark binary, altruism versus self-interest, individualism versus collectivism, mysticism versus reason. All right. In kind of summing up, I want to say, as such, only a didactic and repetitive and highly curated responses could solve these paradigmatic problems and questions, and essential and fundamental problems. So Rand wrote, as she says, not the way people actually spoke, but the way they ought to speak. And this manner of speaking was ubiquitously presented in the oral transmissions in an identical syntactical, semantic, and stylistic manner in all of her characters. So behind the talk, Rand was implicitly teaching her readers a lesson. She was giving them, in the speeches of all her characters, a method of cognition. And we learn about irreducible primaries, we learn about abstractions from abstractions, we learn about concept formation, we learn about logical corollaries. Almost every time a character opened his or her mouth, especially the heroes, each in effect was saying, think as if your life depended on it. Not the basis or stuff or agenda of a traditional novel. So if The Fountainhead is most functional as a work in moral psychology, Atlas Shrugged, in its canonization of capitalism, is most functional, I think, as a work in epistemology. And now, against the backdrop of these considerations, Rand was writing not romantic realism, I think, given all that I've said entailed romanticism, but attempting a new type of novel, a name for which I don't think yet exists, but which, when coined, will place it there as a genius of a novel as ever has been written. Thanks.
Good stuff. Thank you. I just wanted to elaborate on the tree trunk story. It was at the beginning of Atlas Shrugged. And from my memory, it was a tree that was like a symbol of hope for the kids and strength and stability. And then one day it got hit by lightning and they realized that, and it died. It just fell over and they realized it was all hollow and dead inside for years anyway, and just being held up by its own rot.
And so, yeah, I can see that as an allegory. I have, lots of stuff to bring up. We encourage people to share the room, to raise your hand if you want to get in on the conversation. Obviously, I want to defer to David. Jack, if you want to bring in, I suspect you're in a place where you can't even unmute at Freedom Fest like me. I went back to my room for this. So David, if you have a question, or I can just get right into things.
I'd like to hold off for a bit. Jason had gave us so much that questions are starting to crowd my mind, but they're ill-formed yet. So I'm going to wait until I have a little more clarity.
That's fair. John, did you have a question for Jason?
Yes, not really. Scott, I am so impressed, Jason. I was an English major, and I have always had a very equivocal attitude and mindset when asked what I thought of Rand as a novelist. And my God, I am humbled. That was just a beautiful, so logical, so well done. It answered many questions that I had that I hadn't worked hard enough to formulate. So just thank you. I'm going to go back and listen to this again and again and again, because that's all I got to say. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, John. I appreciate that.
And this is just part one. I just want to go over some of the stuff that you talked about, because I mean, a lot of it seems like your issue is more the characters that were Rand's voice, much more in Atlas Shrugged, maybe everyone in the Gulch, and then you brought up Rourke and Mallory. But I mean, one of the things of the Fountainhead is that, you know, there are the four different sections for the four different characters: Rourke, Keating, Wynand, and Tui. And so, you know, I mean, there were more different types of characters, not all that were just speaking for her. And so I guess, I mean, would you say that there is more of that in Atlas Shrugged than the Fountainhead? And that's maybe just where her style developed to.
Well, I think she got a lot more didactic in the Fountainhead, obviously because she had her mind expanded, her notion of concept formation expanded, and in the widest sense of the term, objectivism really began to take form in Atlas Shrugged. But I still think that there are allegorical forms in the Fountainhead where she wasn't, and this is, I mean, it's not a criticism, because I understand what she was doing as a novelist, which is probably why she couldn't write a lot more novels. She still wasn't able to give a sense of indistinguishability to all the characters. I mean, Mallory still sounds like Dominic, who ends up sounding like Dagny anyway, and Rourke sounds a lot like Dagny, I like Dominic, and
what Dominic was a little different. She destroys statues.
No, in their actions, but in their syntactical, the structure of their conversations, the word choice. There is a ubiquity, a ubiquitous way in which they all sound alike that Rand was not able to. That sounded very much the way Rand wrote her nonfiction and the way Rand herself talked and wrote, that I think she was not able to give them separate, distinguished voices. I mean, wouldn't you agree that there's a way in which when Rourke is explaining the nature of secondhanders and in his courtroom speech and Mallory is talking about art and so on, that they all sound like deputized stand-ins for each other. I mean, they all certainly share the same sense of life, but there's a manner of talk which which gives them a univocality of identity intellectually that that is there. And I mean, I enjoy it, but I see it also as sort of Rand unable to really give each person, for want of a better word, a colloquially different way of speaking. They all speak in intellectual speak in the same kind of manner. Even Tuhe sounds inversely like the inverse of Rourke, of course, but his manner of talk, his choice of words, that's what I mean. I mean, so they do have different quirks and they do have different identities as individuals, but when they open their mouth to speak, there is a way in which they sound alike. They don't have distinct intellectual voices. That's what I meant.
I can understand that. I just, you know, there's at least Stephen Mallory was the guy that tried to shoot Tui at one point, I think. And their relationship develops. He's kind of realizing this stuff. And yes, he does get to that same place.
But I
want to touch also on the train victims. I think there's been a continuing theme in objectivism of saying that professors can be either the most morally good or more evil than, you know, Stalin or dictators, depending on what worldview the professors hold.
Well, here I find that section to be quite... Rand stated explicitly that people should not be judged for even what they say, but for what they do. And here she's off them. She's killed them off for their ideas, for the beliefs they hold, that they'll, you know. And given the fact that people are not infallible, given the fact that people can hold such beliefs, there are two children that are innocent children that are actually killed off because their mother hold erroneous beliefs. And, you know, she's packed off the toddlers to death, and she put her two children to sleep in the berth above her, carefully tucking them in, protecting them from the drafts and jolts. A mother whose husband held a government job enforcing directives. It seems strange that we would hold such individuals to the same standard of evil as we would hold, you know, one of the actual moochers who are issuing directives, who are torturing Galt, who are enacting policies that are destroying, that is, they're committing actual acts and enforcing actions that on a threshold of decency, someone who holds those beliefs, we're not entirely sure that they've actually acted on them and committed actions that are harming someone. Given against the backdrop of Rand's own statement that, you know, we should not necessarily judge people based on their beliefs or what they actually say, but on their actions, that she gleefully offs them, kills them off. It would have been sufficient to show that faulty epistemology, faulty metaphysics actually do lead to train wrecks, sexual impotence, all those things. But it seems a bit hyperbolic to now introduce the people on the train. It's almost a way of justifying the death of those people by saying in some sense that they're just as guilty, or the passengers have sinned sufficiently to substitute for the known looters. And so I don't know what people think about that, but that's my least favorite part of Atlas Shrugged, actually.
I think that's fair.
Can I jump in?
Sure.
I don't know how to raise my hand if I'm on the speaker's list, so forgive me if I'm interrupting. But I wanted to say I I agree completely with what Jason's saying about that train scene, the Wreck of the Taggart train in the tunnel and the, you know, going through the passengers. The plot necessity of that wreck is that it brings Dagny back. She can't maintain her personal strike. And so she's got to come back. That's the plot relevance of that. But, you know, it doesn't require this, in effect, the blame that's being put on the and the justification for the deaths of these people as if they deserved it. But I want to push a little bit more, Jason, on the Fountainhead. I've always had a certain preference for that over Atlas, although I think Atlas is fabulous and vastly superior on many counts, but the Fountainhead just has more individuality about it. And that's, I think, what you're challenging. Dominique and Wynand are interesting characters because they have good things mixed with bad things in there, and they struggle. And Rourke himself struggles to understand, you know, the principle behind the Dean. He makes mistakes. And he helps Peter Keating with his projects, which he, you know, probably should not have done. He just couldn't stand to see a building poorly done. But these people learned to and developed as characters through the story, especially Dominique and Wynand. And Dominique turned out okay, Wynand didn't. But their struggles and, you know, reflected through their different relationship work, I always found just more psychologically interesting. Like, these are, there's interactions here that are, where people are learning, they're reacting, and more individualized. So I don't know if I can just equate the Fountainhead and as a single voice. Maybe the people do speak alike syntactically, in a sense, but I think the characterizations are, there's much more variety in the Fountainhead, and for that reason, to me, more interest literarily than in Atlas. So anyway, I just wanted that. I'm just pushing back a little bit on that point of yours and following up on the point Scott made earlier.
David, I agree with you. I think that the Fountainhead is, from a literary standpoint, it's a superior. Well, if we're going to judge it as a traditional novel, I think the Fountainhead is vastly superior judging it as a traditional novel to Atlas Shrugged for many reasons. I think what she was attempting in Atlas Shrugged was something much more different, much more revolutionary and radical than the Fountainhead. And I do think, for the reasons that you said, that there is some kind of, Dominique is not someone who's born full blown from the head of Athena, out of Zeus's head. We do see her struggle. We do see her. Rand said she was herself in a bad mood, but we do see her go from a dark, sort of cynical, pessimistic, paralyzed by doom, not by doom, but paralyzed by a kind of the corruptness of the world and the sense that good cannot thrive in a world that's rotten to the core, to someone who was inspired by Rourke and liberated from the idea that evil will triumph. And that's one of the most liberating and inspiring parts of the Fountainhead, is actually to see Dominique be liberated from her own self and cured her own self-enslavement to a world that she believes in, which no good can thrive. And it's also a part of the Fountainhead that I think, in spite of Rand's notion of self, that, you know, celebrating the self-contained ego, we see that there's a little there's a little bit of a pushback to that idea. That is, Rourke does seem to have a self-contained ego. I don't know where he gets it from. But the other characters seem not so much so to have complete self-contained egos. That is, Dominique does seem to need to witness Rourke's triumph and to see that the super strength of this man who can withstand all the rottenness and the impotence of the world and the triumph above it to liberate herself from that she herself can't do it. She couldn't do it on her own. She was kind of caught up in, mired in revulsion and contempt. And so Rand, you know, did say that a spirit can run dry, that she herself required her husband, Frank's, constant encouragement during the dark periods of writing The Fountainhead to make her go on. And so that's one of the beautiful things about The Fountainhead, is that the idea of a self-contained ego, well, maybe in the strict sense that Rand meant it, that we don't really need other people to validate or know our values. We share them. We don't need people we need other people to share our values. We don't get values from other people. But certainly that's one of the rewarding things about The Fountainhead, is to see how Dominic's almost dependency on Rourke, in a sense, makes her blossom and thrive. I agree with you. I think there's more there's more character development in The Fountainhead, and especially Wynand's realization that having sold his soul, there's nothing more to live for. That is, tying the premises and tying the connections of his life together, seeing that he can't escape from reality, he can't escape from the false philosophy and the premises that he's lived his life by, that there is growth, although it ends tragically in him killing himself. So that's a lot to think about.
Thanks, Jason. And I just want to mention, Stephen Cox wrote a wonderful essay on The Fountainhead. This is back in 93, but I think it's on our website somewhere. That is interesting. One of his central points is that there's a theme of individualism in the book. That's like, he describes it as like the DNA in every cell of a body. It's everywhere in all its different, despite the difference in all the keep this allegory going, despite all the differences that DNA creates in the body to create all the different kinds of tissues and organs and so forth, it's still the same DNA. And it's a wonderful metaphor. So anyway, thanks. I'll turn this over back to Scott and anyone else who has questions.
Yeah, again, we want to encourage people to share the room and raise your hand if you want to get involved in the conversation. Jason, I don't know if you still have that those tenets of romanticism handy. You know, as you were reading them, I thought that I could argue that she agrees with most of those, even maybe the nature part to some degree.
You think so? I mean, Rand wasn't
I could see both interpretations, honestly.
I don't think she was in awe of nature.
Well, she was in awe of its power if man didn't conquer it the way it would just, you know, even those... scenes. I mean, she preferred to see a skyscraper as a sign of civilization, but I mean, I think of like the description of Cortland Holmes at the beginning and the boy on the bicycle.
But that's not nature. That's man who has sort of, I mean, Howard Rourke has a sentence where he says when he sees a set of trees or something, he just wants to cut them down and replace them with. I think Rand had a kind of contempt or a kind of, not contempt, a kind of uneasiness with nature. Whereas the romantic poets are sort of, another thing about romanticism is the experience of the sublime vis-a-vis nature. I hardly think that a Randian character would feel the sense of sublime with nature. I mean,
yeah, and they would feel... Yeah, I'll grant the nature was probably the weakest one, but can you remind me of one or two of the others?
The elevation of strong senses of feelings and emotions over reason, interest in the common man and individual, especially children, the elevation of children, importance of imagination.
I think some, you know, because obviously imagination matters to creativity.
Yeah.
Maybe she didn't, do as much with kids. I'm trying to think of, I guess it is partially because she used that qualifier of romantic realism. I'm not sure if you're getting a call right now or.
No, I just hung it up.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Maybe it has to do with more of a romantic realism where some of those elements are there. I wasn't even jotting them when you were saying them, but there may not be. I'm trying to think of romantic writers that did elevate children like that.
Well, Blake's The Chimney Sweeper, you know, where he sort of depicts the horror of industrialization and talks about the sores and the lungs. And I mean, that's a prime example.
Right. But I mean, Dickens wasn't romantic.
No, I wouldn't necessarily call him a romantic writer. But also there, you know, there's also a rich literature out there about when we talk about when the demise of reason started and the revolt against reason. And, you know, some people, I wish Stephen were here because Stephen and I would, Stephen writes about this in his book on postmodernism. I don't know that he would necessarily put it with the romantics, but there are people who say, you know, well, the Frankfurt School, or it starts with, Leonard Peikoff in the dim hypothesis talks about the beginning of the beginning. You know, it actually starts with, I think this is ridiculous. It starts with Plato, that Plato himself. I think that's just stretching it too far. But there are people like, I don't think Isaiah Berlin does this, but there are people who point out that the romantics in their exaltation of feelings and their celebration of some of them of irrationalism were greater enemies of reason than some of even the Enlightenment thinkers like Kant, who was not an enemy of reason, but clearly was someone who thought that reason had vast limitations and that, you know, we could only access, we could never know things in themselves. And that the romantics were the villains in the sense that their emphasis on feelings and subjectivity, that's another hallmark of romanticism, is that this, the precursors to existentialism, that the primacy of feelings and subjectivity, and if not the exaltation of irrationalism, certainly the extent to which irrationalism is not something that is, unlike the Enlightenment, is not something that is to be eschewed, but is to be celebrated. These are all features of romanticism. But one thing that you get from reading a ton of stuff on romanticism is that there's no sense of monolithicity among any other romantic writers. So it's a very hard term to have a kind of precise definition, because the romantic writers themselves varied so much in their sensibilities. And so the chief constitutive or chief fundamental characteristics boiled down to something like, you know, a celebration of nature, feeling, the primacy of feelings and subjectivity and emotions. But very few romantics you find are going to celebrate the primacy of reason over something like feelings. There are elements of romanticism, I think, in Rand's work, but it just doesn't, I don't see how it maps on so tightly to, the element of didacticism that you find in Atlas Shrugged is just not something that you would find even in, aside from Victor Hugo's long historical essays that Rand herself complained about and that I can't get through in Les Misérables, I wouldn't classify Victor Hugo as a didactic novelist. You know, you just don't find that in the Romantics at all, that this kind of didacticism. Even Hard Times, which is a pretty hard-hitting social novel by Dickens, his quote-unquote social novels where he's depicting the plight of the poor, they're not very didactic. I mean, you feel sorry for these poor people, but it doesn't come from like speeches about haranguing people that the working class are being screwed over. So I want to maintain that there's a term, I don't want to call it egoic realism, but there's a term, Rand really was a revolutionary. There's no novel like Atlas Shrugged, right? And there's no, I don't think any novel like that has been written since. I don't think there's a reason why. I mean, she got away with it. I don't think an accurate term has been coined to describe Atlas Shrugged. I think we can see The Fountainhead as a traditional novel. But I don't know that Atlas Shrugged, and I think it's a paucity of imagination on the part of readers why Atlas Shrugged gets discredited, because people can't read it sympathetically and realize that Ayn Rand was doing something revolutionary, brand new. I think most of us as readers of traditional novels map on those sensibilities to Atlas Shrugged and don't give Rand a charitable ear. And I'd like to see a term that's coined. I don't know that it's, you know, I don't know that it's even necessary, but it's with an awareness that it's not this, it's not that, it's not this.
Yeah, well, you bring up some really good points about how, you know, even within tenets of romanticism, it's not hard and fast, and the people at the beginning of the movement are going to be different than the people at the end of the movement. And obviously, if she came much later, that's going to be even, you know, a bigger gap.
Mm-hmm.
I think that happens with things like the Enlightenment as well, where, you know, we saw PragerU, for example, say that the Enlightenment was bad and kind of the beginning of socialism. And they're pointing out guys like Rousseau and Kant, mm-hmm. which, you know, they're not really our Enlightenment guys. And that you can argue not really even should be part of the Enlightenment. But I think that same thing that in Romanticism, you know, when, happens on intellectual movements as well.
Right, exactly, yeah. So maybe Rand would be like a third phase romantic. I mean, there's a way in which there's a second wave of romantics, like Wordsworth was considered a sort of second wave romantic. Maybe Rand could be seen as a sort of a third wave romantic. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's possible. Yeah.
Jason, can I jump in once again? Rand herself had a definition of romanticism as based on the idea of man's volition and the pursuit of values, and that in the artistic form, especially at least in a novel, there would be the plot was governed by a clash of values among people pursuing different ones. Maybe you're going to mention this in part two of your presentation. If so, we can get to it then. But I just wondered if you would had any thoughts on that, since you hadn't mentioned it.
Right. I was going to more talk about how Rand was working with a new version of Romanticism that seemed conceptually to be a radical departure from the traditional 18th century notion, and whether there it's a radical departure, but whether there was any conceptual linkage that would make her version seem to be like a cousin, a distant cousin to the 18th century notion, or if you know, it was just really something that was completely different and had no relationship to Romanticism at all. I tend to think that if we look at the primacy of the individual, which is a feature of all forms of romanticism, that is the elevation of the individual, and sort of ignore the notions of subjectivity and feelings, that there's a way to make sense of Rand's. I'm going to be as charitable to Rand as possible as a philosopher. I think that's what we do as philosophers. We give a charitable reading and say that there's a way that we would have to reconfigure third wave romanticism as drastically as possible. And that's why she would classify people like Miki Spillane as a romantic writer, which some people would just laugh at as being ridiculous. So I'll probably get into that. Yes, I will get into that in the second part of the talk. That'll be more dealing with Rand's reconfiguration of romanticism while not making it a neologism, right? It's not just going off and redefining concepts and not having any kind of awareness of how the tradition actually merged, but that where the accent falls on her definition has more to do with the individual and the clash. And you see that in Victor Hugo's novels, right, where it's a clash between the individual and the norms of society and so on and so forth. So, yeah, thanks, David. That's something that I'll deal with in part two.
Okay, great. I'll look forward to it. Thanks, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think a lot of what you're saying is fair. I think just from a practical perspective, you know, we can say that it's not really a proper novel in the sense of the classical definition, but in terms of a vehicle that helped her and her ideas get noticed, and maybe the nature of the novel has changed, and that's not as, you know, it can't be done again like that. But, you know, I think that ultimately there, at the time, at least in that context for how, you know, novels were widely read, it was a good strategy.
Yeah, I think so. And I think had Rand's ideas not been so radical, it would have come across as kitsch or as campy or... and there are, of course, her detractors who are just a bunch of mean-spirited sons of bitches, as Rand would call them, who just want to dismiss Rand, right? And just say that, you know, everything is derivative. And I mean, look, David and I have PhDs in philosophy. We've read the history of philosophy. We know that Rand was very original and had something very unique to say, having read the history of philosophy. Had she not been as original and unique in much of what she said, then it would have just been like schlock theater, really. And Atlas Shrugged is not schlock theater. It's not kitsch. It's there's something. I mean, anybody who reads those speeches, you're left with an appreciation of the profound insight this woman had in psychology and in so many spheres of thought. And I think ultimately that is why it works, which is why the kids who are appreciative of her philosophy think good philosophy, bad novel, because they're working. We're working with you know, a conventional notion of what a novel is. So yeah.
Well, this is great. I'm glad you did this. It I think it is a little controversial, but it is good to talk about and. explore these issues. I'm looking forward to part two. We want to thank everyone for joining us, especially Professor Hill. And next week, we're going to be back on Clubhouse Tuesday and Thursday, I believe. I'll double check that. But we're going to try to do more on Clubhouse. And you know, if you're in Vegas this week or this weekend, we're at Freedom Fest. Jag is out here, too. We'd love you to come up to the booth. We got some swag. But just in the meantime, again, Professor Hill, thank you for doing this topic. Thank you to everyone who joined us. And we will see you all again next time.